Welcome back to the show. 15 and 60, we're actually going to do this one in two parts today. So the second half will come out tomorrow, hopefully relatively early in the morning so we can get you both of them. But what we're going to start with here is the fact that we're sponsored by SeatGeek. Use the CapSpace code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. And we're going to go in order of the standings like we did last week in the 15 and 60. But since Liam was doing the Raptors this week, we know that they are behind the Celtics by three games, although tied in the last column. The Celtics actually played six more games than the Raptors have with this weird London thing they have going on. But they were Liam's team this week, so why don't you take it away with the Toronto Raptors, Liam?
Sure. So they're 7-2 since the last 15 and 60, 27-10 overall, third in net rating, third in offense, and eighth in defense. And obviously their playoff odds are greater than 99%. They're going to make the playoffs. So they've had a lot of changes, you know, from last year to this year, obviously, which I think a lot of people have covered already. And over the last couple weeks, I think DeMar DeRozan's really stood out as the biggest part of, you know, those changes, and that he's really added some stuff to his game, and not just the three-point shot. He's shooting 39% on threes from on like three attempts a game, but he's also passing much better. His assist percentage is much higher than usual, and you can just tell by watching him whenever he gets. They played Milwaukee twice this week, so we know Milwaukee likes to, you know, have a heavy shifting defense and really challenge teams to make, you know, pass to beat them, and he really did that a lot. They put up huge offensive outings against Milwaukee both times, and you can just see, like, just whenever he gets doubled in the pick and roll, he's really become much better at trying to make plays out of that, and just overall he's been much more effective. Career high true shooting percentage, 59%, and he's shooting great from the mid-range like always. So my question is to you guys is, you know, how do you guys view him differently in, you know, through the lens of, you know, the playoffs? Do you view him as a much different player there, because we know that he's had his struggles in the past?
Well, I do think that he is a guy who, if you have a long switchable team with good athletes to make him play one-on-one, that he can be shut down. He's not an absolutely elite guy going against the best defenders. Now, they can try to get the switch with smaller defenders. There aren't many, if any, teams in the East that have a lot of guys who can guard him if they get the right matchup. But, you know, for whatever reason, he has not succeeded in the playoffs. And to me, the biggest development in his game is if he can continue to make the three-pointer consistently to the point that he actually gets guarded, then that lets Kyle Lowry play much better. I think that the fact that DeRozan doesn't get guarded when he doesn't have the ball makes things really difficult for Lowry and the rest of the offense, and so you kind of end up having to run everything through DeRozan. And so if he can work more off the ball, I think that's something that can give them some much needed diversity in the playoffs. The question is just, is he going to continue being this aggressive from three, and is he going to continue, more importantly, making them? And none of us know the answer to that yet. I mean, how does his shot just look to you? I mean, does he look to have confidence and versatility taking that shot, or is he kind of still like taking an hour to get it off and he's only getting them because teams just aren't guarding him at all?
No, I think it's a pretty versatile shot, as far as he's taken, I think, a couple off the dribble. I saw when teams went under in the pick and roll, he got one where it was like an offensive rebound in the corner. He sprinted and took like a fadeaway and then stared down the bench on the way back. But like, it was just a really aggressive shot. So you can tell, like, when he's feeling it, like, he's confident shooting that shot, which is obviously a big thing, because like you said, I think teams are going to challenge him to make it in the playoffs, and they're going to want to see him do it, you know, on the playoff stage before they really start guarding that, because, you know, the other aspects of the games are a little bit more dangerous overall.
Well, one thing that concerns me about what DeRozan, like, kind of with that, yeah, of course it's great that he's shooting the three-point shot, but what you notice is there's a heavy correlation with the games where he's playing well, where he takes a lot of threes. And so if they're going in cycles, so like against Dallas, let's say, he really struggled in that game from the field. He only took two threes in that game, so he was 3 of 16 from the field, 0 for 2 from three. But then when he was feeling it, like he was in that 52 point game against the Bucks, it's a mixed setup. And so I don't know, because when I watch them, I haven't gotten a read for this yet about whether there really is an ebb and flow like that. But what that means is, when if that concept is right, what that means is if he faces a better defender, maybe he won't get into a rhythm and then be shooting his threes. And if he's not shooting them, then that's a concern. But again, we need a much bigger sample size here, because he's, as of the last time I checked, you know, overall for the season, he was still at about, like, I was a little bit over one made three per game. So this recent surge is wonderful, and if it continues, that's encouraging. But we need to see it extend to really say this is what he is now.
And just to touch on just other ways that defense, like, if he hits the three, three, that's obviously great. But the passing is something I worry about in the playoffs too, because a lot of those short rolls, they're going to be passing to, you know, if he gets doubled in the pick and roll, he's going to be passing to Serge Ibaka, and maybe they'll put OG at the four some. And that's not exactly a dynamic, you know, passing duo right there. So while they've been much better this season at like passing the ball, working it around for good 3-point shots, there were some instances where Ibaka was just really slow with his decision making and kind of held the ball when they had an advantage, and then the defense recovered. So there are a couple ways that I think teams can, you know, are going to be able to, you know, minimize his effect on the game. And then not to mention defensively, I think he's been really struggling still in the games I've seen. The defensive rating is 8 points worse with him on the court, and they're giving up a ton of shots at the rim. And I think that's partly due to them giving up a lot of dribble penetration. And DeRozan's a big part of that problem. And that some plays he'll have, you know, really good sequences, will climb up a guy and slide well and be really aggressive, but the consistency with his effort just isn't there really.
Well, now we're looking forward to seeing OG Anunoby against some of the best players. He had a solid game one-on-one against James Harden earlier when we did a show on that. They play the Cavs, which are doing Twitter NBA show on Thursday, and he also matched up, of course, with Giannis a couple times in the past week. So what did you see from him guarding Giannis Antetokounmpo?
I thought it was really effective. A couple of the times that Giannis tried to like back him down or, you know, work his way into a, you know, shorter mid-range shot, he didn't really budge much, and that was kind of the scouting report on OG coming out. He's got those, you know, thick, strong legs. He's got a really strong base that he's hard to move. So I think that's huge for the guys he's, you know, going to be matching up in the playoffs if they face the Cavs or they face the Bucks. You know, Giannis and LeBron, there aren't, you know, anybody that's going to stop those two, but he physically is as well equipped to do that as just about anybody. And with how he's been playing on offense, you're going to be able to keep him on the floor, you know, without being a huge liability on that end. Where I think he does have to work is defensively. I didn't think he was great in help. He was slow on a couple rotations and just slow recognizing switches, stuff that's going to come in time. And obviously he's a rookie just getting used to NBA defense. So nothing to be like alarmed about long term, but I do think, you know, when we reach the playoffs this year, he could have some of those, you know, rookie mental errors that you see from younger guys.
And you mentioned some of the younger guys. Delon Wright had a career high 25 points against the Bulls, a guy who really stuffs the box score as well, but certainly not someone who has a conventional game. He is shooting 38% on his three-pointers, but I think he's only taken, you know, maybe like 100 or so this year. It might even be a lot less. No, I'm sorry. It's
like 50.
Yeah, so not enough to say that it's any, we can make anything of that. It's really more his willingness to take it, but he's not really willing to take him so far, but yet he's still been a really nice player for them. So what did you see from him in your work?
I just really like him as a player. He's such, you know, in the league, he's very unique as far as how he gets his baskets. He's taken 56% of his shots at the rim, which is just ridiculous for a point guard. And just the way he does it, he doesn't have a lot of vertical explosion. It's all like touch and deception and, you know, creativity with his Euro steps, you know, reverses, just reaching out past defenders, off-footed shots. And he's just really fun to watch from that perspective. And like you mentioned, he had a huge game against the Bulls. Just a nose for the ball, like stuff that point guards don't usually do. He was getting a lot of like putbacks and, you know, fighting for the ball amongst bigs and stuff like that. And defensively, I think he's got great potential, you know, good length, you know, great sense of where to be on the court, anticipation. He had, you know, read some passing lanes a couple times. So I'm really high on him, but I don't, where do you see him long term? Because I know he's kind of an older guy in the league. I think he's 25 now, and he could be a guy that could hit the, you know, free agency market the year after next year with, you know, the crowded cap sheet that the Raptors have. And I kind of view him as like a starter level player, especially at that point when he's going to be hitting his prime and presumably improving. But what do you guys see from him as a player? Like, how do you value him?
Well, for me, he kind of falls into a similar mode as Elfrid Payton. Still, I think older than Payton, in fact. But his shooting, same way, both those guys that can get to the rim. Wright, much more efficient, I think. And also Wright has really been able to make more of a difference on defense than I think Payton has been able to, obviously in a much better defensive ecosystem as well. Not a guy that I feel he's going to be a tough fit to really play big minutes on a good team, because with his lack of shooting, it's tough to play him off the ball, but he's not ever going to really be dynamic enough, again, in part because of that lack of shooting, to be the lead ball handler for a team. You're going to have either a two or a three who's going to be, you know, similar to a DeRozan type, for example, who is going to be able to be the primary offensive impetus. And now you're playing right off the ball. And, you know, maybe if he can continue to improve his jump shot and more importantly, take more of those shots, he really just does not look to take those shots right now, until he went 4 out of 5, of course, against the Bulls. But certainly defensively, I think he's totally there. He's got some size, some switchability, although he's not incredibly strong. I love his anticipation and all that. Hard to see how he becomes a starter, but given where he was drafted in the early 20s, as long as he can avoid injuries, I think he could be a quality player, but the type of guy, you know, you might spend $5-7 million a year on potentially, you know, and a guy who could play somewhat similar of a role to the dearly departed from Toronto, Corey Joseph, going forward as he gets into his prime.
Right. Well, I think we're a little bit off on like how we view him, because I think he's a little bit better, but I don't know. We'll see over time, obviously. So
you think he can be like a solid starter? He's the type of guy you would pay, you know, $15 million a year to, assuming that he develops in a realistic way.
Kind of closer to like 10 to 13, I'd say. I view him as like a starter, but not like a high end starter. So like a guy that could, you know, 20th to 30th best point guard in the league, or maybe a little bit better than that. But I don't know. I really like the way he plays. I think he has a little bit more ability to play in the pick and roll than you do, obviously. The shot's obviously the big question, you know. Will that 3-point shot stick? And there's just no way to know that off the sample size we've had. Obviously he doesn't have a good history going back to it in college, and I think he's shooting poor from the free throw line, but there have been guys obviously who have drastically improved their jump shot, so that's the big variable in all this, as it is with a lot of guys. So that'll be something that's interesting to monitor. But
yeah, and a couple more notes on him. You mentioned his work in the pick and roll. Not a guy who really does anything in the pick and roll other than go to the basket or look for the pass, and he does get to the basket quite often for it. And you mentioned that he takes such a high percentage of his shots at the rim, but he's not the number one guy on the scouting report. It's also worth noting, I think, that he does not play very often even as the only point guard on the floor. In fact, he plays only 21% at point guard, 74% at shooting guard. He's usually playing next to Van Vliet or Lowry, and both of those guys can shoot the ball, right? I mean, he's really playing as a two, and so not all point guards that he's going to be matched with. I mean, I think it's possible that he could be a starter level player, but so much to me depends on the fit, and his contract will be expiring a year ahead of when Lowry and Ibaka is due, and so he will be restricted. I just don't see another team coming in with a big offer sheet to say, hey, this guy is definitely our solution at starting point guard, especially when you consider, you know, he's going to be basically 26 at that point.
And he won't basically be 26. Yeah. He'll actually be 26.
Yeah. Well, it was either 26 or 27. I went with 26. But
yeah, he turns 20. Wait, actually, he'll be 27 at that point. He turns 26 during the playoffs this year.
Yeah. So that's really, if you're going to give a guy a big 4-year contract, so you're basically going to say whatever he is at that point, that's probably what you anticipate. So it's, if he does get as much as you're talking about, Liam, I think that that's the kind of contract that turns out to maybe not be that great sometimes, and because you're paying close to starter money, if not starter money, for a guy who he's not going to be a high-end guy. He may well even be, you know, if you put the right system around him, a guy who can be kind of a lower end starter. But I don't know. I mean, you watched a lot of him recently. He does a lot of things well. He's, as you noted, he's a hard guy to classify, but it's really more the fit issues for me than it is just problems with him as an actual player, in kind of the same way that we've seen with some big men. You know, Valanciunas is another guy even on that team who has a lot of skills. He's a good player, but just the fit becomes really difficult around him. And that's why I think there just aren't that many teams that he's going to work for. And that's why I would expect his market to be
low. No, that's fair. And I was just thinking in terms of just guys that like are, you know, having, you know, are perceived as having good seasons this year, with guys like, you know, Austin Rivers or like Chris Dunn. And like, I think he could be those caliber players. And now, again, those aren't like, you know, guys you want as your starters going to the playoffs. But if you're a team that's looking for a point guard, there's probably not many options on the free agency market, because all the good ones are locked up long term. And with the Raptors, they have a lot of money committed long term. So I just thought he was a guy that, you know, teams might be able to get, and he might be a good, but that's obviously a ways away. But you mentioned Jonas Valanciunas, and I think it's interesting right now, the center situation on the team, as far as, you know, what their rotation is going to be. Valanciunas's minutes are way down compared to, you know, his whole career, because Jakob Poeltl is taking more of those minutes. And if you look at like like the role that they have for their center on the team with high usage guys like DeRozan and Lowry, you know, shoots a lot, obviously, that they want a low usage big that's good at, you know, rolling to the basket and sliding his feet defensively. And I think Poeltl is a little bit better in those areas. He's better. He's more efficient as a role man as a role man with 1.3 points per possession compared to Valanciunas's 1.2. And he's a great screener. Poeltl is, with very good feet, and he's got touches and finisher. He's got shooting 73% at the rim. And just as a guy that can like fit as a role player, he's kind of stealing some of Valanciunas's minutes. So I don't know what they're going to do at center long term, but I think Ibaka is probably going to see a lot of minutes at the five in the playoffs. But how do you guys see the center rotation shaking out this year for them?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly be surprising if Valanciunas were closing many games at center, and you know, I don't think he has closed many for them this season. A couple other things, you just had some quick observations here on some of the other guys, and you know, then we can get to that last question.
So Serge Ibaka is having a great season shooting. Is 37% from three and 54% from the mid-range, which I imagine has to be up there, you know, among the elites in the league in that area, and he's shooting a ton from there, obviously. So he really juices up their spacing. He's great at that.
I think his shot selection has improved since the playoffs last year.
I'd agree with that. Like I said before, I mean, he's definitely making an effort to pass more and a little more, you know, plays off, you know, attacking closeout, stuff like that. But he's still a very slow decision maker, which doesn't really fit with the way they're trying to play, you know, move it around quick, a lot of passing, three-point shots. So he's going to struggle there. And defensively, I think he's, you know, lost a little bit of agility, which, you know, you would expect at this age for him. He still has really good, you know, speed in, if he's just sprinting one direction. I think he had a block in transition. He had several blocks in one of the games against the Bucks, so he can still move in some areas. But whenever he's trying to, you know, attack a closeout, or when he's closing out, or when he switched on to a perimeter player, I think he wasn't nearly as agile as I remember him being. So that's something to keep an eye on for him. And Kyle Lowry, I think his usage has dipped a little bit. He's not getting to the line as much. So some of the signs that you'd see from a guy that's getting older, you know, I think he's what, 31, 32 now. So he's definitely still, you know, extremely valuable player for them. Shoots a ton of threes, shoots it pretty well, and he's obviously really respected, you know, out there. So he's going to have some gravity in that area. And he's playing a lot of those lineups with Fred VanVleet right now. Like you said earlier, he's put VanVleet playing a lot, and he's getting matched up against the two. And the Bucks were targeting him in the post, and he's actually a really stout post defender for just how tough he is, and you know, how much he'll fight for position. So he's actually, those are lineups that are a little more viable than I think most people would think. So he's still an extremely valuable player, even though I think he's probably slipping from that all-star status. Although I don't know, maybe he's an all-star this year, but he's kind of getting towards the brink of that rather than a surefire guy.
Yeah, and a couple other things that you noted here is that they are trying really hard not to give up threes, and that means that teams take a lot of shots at the rim. But with Ibaka, I mean, especially when he's playing at the four, Valanciunas, Poeltl are guys who, when they're in position, can be pretty intimidating. So they have, you know, in a lot of their main lineups, more rim protection than nearly any team in the league. Ibaka is probably the best shot blocking four in the league, even still at this point, when you consider that there aren't that many of those guys any longer. So they do at least protect the rim pretty well, and that'll be a very interesting to see against Cleveland, whether those guys can have an effect or they're just going to get spaced out as they have been in the playoffs. So you're and you also noted Norman Powell is basically like not playing right now, and poor Powell, I mean, he was starting or playing a lot of minutes, and then he suffered that hip contusion, and after a nasty fall, and OG went in the starting lineup and he got Wally Pipped, and now he can't even get on the floor anymore.
Well, fortunately, he's not poor anymore, so it's not that big a deal.
I mean, that's going to be another very interesting contract, which we felt like was a good value. He got the Josh Richardson extension, making about $11 million per season over the next four after this one. It's very difficult to trade him right now with that extension, but he is he might be able to help a team, but obviously his value is going to decline simply by dint of not playing. So, Danny, this is the question that Liam posed here at the end. What is their best lineup in the playoffs? Lowry and DeRozan got to be out there. Ibaka is probably going to play at center. Ananobi is really their only guy they have who can guard some of the best wings. And, you know, Giannis and LeBron, they're likely to play one of those teams in the playoffs. They'll need his switchability if they play against the Celtics. Who is the fifth guy to you? And Liam, same question to you when Sandy is done.
It's a tough decision because what you're looking for, you don't need much playmaking because you have Lowry and DeRozan who can shoulder a lot of that. But you want somebody who can stretch the of four who opposing defenses will respect there, and ideally somebody who could switch the most positions possible, especially if you want OG guarding the other team's three most of the time. If that's your default, then you want a guy like that. They don't have Patrick Patterson this year. That would be a logical fit. So as of right now, I feel a little queasy about it, but I'm going to go with CJ Miles just because they don't need that much from that spot, and I think he's the best, kind of the best square peg to fit in that round hole of the ones that they have.
Yeah, and there could still be a place even for Powell at some point in some of those lineups as well. I mean, when you consider how small many of the teams that they're going to be playing will be in the playoffs, will be playing down the end of games. What do you think, Liam?
Well, I think it comes down to four guys, you know, Van Fleet, Wright, Miles, and Powell. And Powell's out of the rotation right now, so I don't know how that's going to work out. Miles, like Danny said, he gives them a lot of shooting. I think if the coaching staff, if they had to make the decision right now, my guess would be Van Fleet, because I think they have a lot of trust in him. And obviously, that'd be a very small lineup, having DeRozan, you know, guarding the other team's three. Personally, maybe it's just, maybe I'm just way too high on him, but I kind of like Wright in that role, because you have a lineup with a lot of shooting there. You know, Ibaka's a great shooter at the five. OG's proven to be a really effective shooter, shooting from the corners. And DeRozan, if he can keep that up, and obviously Lowry has a ton of gravity, so you can kind of afford a little bit of a lesser shooter at that position. And defensively, I think you would give him a lot of, you know, switching versatility, and, you know, just somebody that can make plays when they're getting a closeout off of those DeRozan pick and rolls.
Yeah, I think we'll end up seeing a renaissance with Powell, because if they play the Bucks, you know, I think if they play Washington, I think that you might be right. If they play Boston, you know, there's just going to be too many bad matchups with Jaylen Brown and Tatum and Marcus Morris, all guys who are going to have a massive size advantage. And if they try to switch more, then they can get taken advantage of if it's Van Vliet, if it's Wright, who is not a very stout guy. Obviously, LeBron, Giannis, all of those. So I think it'll end up being either Miles or Powell, but even if they're going to play OG at the four, you might also say, you know, maybe it's Poeltl at the five and then Ibaka at four, and we're just going to try to go a little bit bigger, you know, especially against a Bucks team that doesn't have a ton of shooting, or if Washington is going to go with Gortat at center and Markieff Morris, maybe you can get away with that. So it's going to be very, very matchup dependent, but I do think they're going to need the two-way play of Powell, because he's still their best guy who can hold up in some of this ISO switch ball that so many of their potential opponents want to play. All right, we'll be back, go through the rest of the upper echelon of the Eastern Conference after this from SeatGeek, and I am getting pretty fired up for these playoffs here. Once playoff time rolls around, even before then, best time saver for tickets is SeatGeek. They aggregate ticket selling sites together, so you don't have to worry about going to 9 sites and then, oh, is there a 10th one I can check now? It's all for you in one place right now. And they also save you time and money by ranking all of the tickets based on value. So you look generally at the type of ticket you want, the section of the stadium you want to sit in, pick the best value, and you're done. You know, what used to be a process that would take 20 minutes and involve a ton of ticket FOMO, now you can get rid of that ticket FOMO and do it by spending 2 minutes or so looking for tickets. That's what I did when I went to a Bucks Wizards game in Milwaukee, got an amazing deal for my fiance and myself. And if you also want to get an amazing deal, you can get started with SeatGeek with $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today. Easy to remember, we talk about CAPSPACE all the time in the program. That's promo code CAPSPACE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Let's get to the Boston Celtics now, leading the East at 33-10. They are 8-3 since the last 15-60, where they have turned it around a little bit. Back up to a 5.3 net rating, fourth in the NBA. They have the 14th ranked offense, which is actually higher than I would have expected, since they have played a fair number of slugfests recently. And the first ranked defense. The question that you pose, which I think is a good one, and so I will pose it to you to get started here, is they have this $8.4 million disabled player exception from Gordon Hayward. And of course, the way that works is if the player's salary is above the mid-level exception, that's what determines the amount of the DP. So it's right at the non-taxpayer mid-level exception. It can only be used to either sign a free agent, which, you know, I'm not sure which free agent as of right now would be worth spending that much much money on, maybe a buyout candidate could emerge later, and that would put them in the driver's seat. Or you can use it to acquire a player in the last season of his contract who makes it up to that amount without sending any salary back. So what just kind of player do you think they will ultimately be looking to acquire? What is their rotation missing?
The reason I thought it was an interesting question is because of Aaron Baines playing really well this year. And originally, I think a lot of us expected that the way this was going to go was it was kind of the best big man available. That it was, you know, whether that was Greg Monroe, if he got bought out, or just somebody on the market. But if Aaron Baines stays healthy, I don't think that's really a need for this team other than depth. And I think Tice has been fine for them. So my instinct is that if they were going to use it, just wing depth is always so important. Maybe somebody or just somebody who they think has a little bit more capability off the dribble, while Rozier has done a nice job this year and Marcus Smart also shoulders some of that responsibility when Kyrie is out, just having another guy. But I don't think the rotation needs anything, which is amazing when you consider Gordon Hayward isn't playing this year. And so the other thing, and I already wrote it, but I don't know.
So if I may quibble with you there briefly.
Sure.
I think they need someone who can really reliably knock down shots.
That's true. But where would you, like, do you think they would fit in with rotation? They'd just probably be like a 10 to 15 minute a game guy. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
I'm good with that. That's a good, as a niche, I think that's a good niche.
Yeah, someone who can play in, and I think maybe help their offense a little bit in those lineups when Kyrie is not playing, when he's out of the game.
Yeah.
What was your next point going
to
be?
So it's weird to step on my own toes, but I've been floating this idea now for a little while, and it builds on your concept of the human trade exception from last year with the last offseason with the Warriors and Kevin Durant. Basically, one of the more interesting ways that Boston could use this, if they decided they didn't want to prioritize getting somebody to help this year, is they could technically, because their contract expires, they could get somebody who is a pending restricted free agent. So the guy that I use in the piece whenever it comes out is Julius Randle, because I think Randle's the most interesting with this. And so the idea would be, like they're probably going to do with Marcus Smart, this is going to be a horrendous year for restricted free agents. So if you can get them on a reasonable contract of whatever duration, they could use that as money to eventually either keep that player and be happy with it, or use that as the kind of ballast in a bigger trade for a bigger player, because right now they have all their money tied up in good guys. So my concept with it was, get Smart and Randle on reasonable contracts, and then if, let's say, Anthony Davis becomes available, you use those guys as the big salary pieces, as opposed to using Al Horford, who could be useful in that, but maybe either A, you want to keep Al Horford, or B, the Pelicans don't consider him a major part of that trade because he's older and all that kind of stuff. So that was my concept for if they don't see a player need to actually get some value from it in a different way.
It's funny to talk about trading Horford, because he was saying a few days ago that, yeah, all the guys who recruited me to Boston are basically gone now.
Yep.
except
I think he talked about that when they were playing Jay Crowder and Isaiah the Cavs, and the Cavs.
Right. Yeah. So as we talked about with Toronto, I think it's interesting to say who are the guys who really should be in their closing lineup. And for me, which three, you know, obviously Kyrie and Horford are going to be out there. We assume they're going to play with Horford at the five. Kyrie is the one. So which three of Marcus Morris, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, and Marcus Smart is it going to be? I think they brought in Morris with the hope that it would be him. He has had this knee injury, has not really been able to produce so far this season, but has more size and switchability, and is obviously a better three-point shooter than Smart. The other problem with him too is he won't hang out on the perimeter. He likes to kind of just go stand in the post, and then when guys do that, you just naturally throw him the ball because you feel bad not throwing it to him, and also he's like in everyone's way, so you got to just throw it to him. But what's your feeling on those three guys? I mean, I think, and then Brown and Tatum, are they going to keep hitting shots the way they have? It's very interesting on a game-to-game basis what that combo is going
to
be.
The biggest concern with Morris for me, beyond it's kind of ancillary to what you were saying before, is the idea that they don't really run a lot of their stuff with him because the ball just stops. You know,
yeah.
The Morris twins have this as an identical flaw where if you want a ball in player's movement system, they're just not going to do it. Like, that's just not who they are. That's not who they've been. And so I don't think against the right teams that you can really do that. The problem is that I think against, let's say, Cleveland, his defensive strength to be able to handle a guy like LeBron, whether that's on switches or as a primary assignment, is incredibly valuable. So I would say it's matchup dependent in that way, but maybe against everybody but Cleveland, I would probably be going at this point with Marcus Smart, just because I think he can be a better cog in the machine. He is switchable in a different way just because he's so goddamn strong. And he has his flaws as a shooter, but I feel like you can handle him more reasonably than you can handle Morris in that role.
Yeah, I think I agree there too, in that against Cleveland, Smart is not really capable. I mean, and obviously these are difficult assignments, but Smart has not proven capable of guarding either LeBron James or Kevin Love in the post. Love is another one, right? If you're going to switch around, and Jaylen Brown can't guard those guys in the post either, by the way. So that's and Smart can do better against those guys than Brown can, because Brown just has, although he has size, has no idea how to use his body any defending any kind of back to the basket scenario. I saw the end of the Celtics Nets game. I know you watched that as well. We'll talk about that more in the Brooklyn section tomorrow, but because they will not be in the top half of the league when we discuss them. But I thought it was interesting that Stevens, with Horford out, closed with Semi Ojeleye at center. He actually went small first, causing the Nets to take Jahlil Okafor out of the game and go with Rondae Hollis-Jefferson at center. And I thought Ojeleye, you know, still continues to be a complete zero on offense, but he had a couple of nice plays, verticality, defending the rim, and he's so strong. He actually had even some good post defense on Okafor that he doesn't like sky off of 2 feet to block shots. He's not really a shot blocker, but if he can get his chest into position, he can be tough to score over for smaller players, just because, you know, he knocks guys backwards when they crash into him in the air.
What I liked about that also was the willingness to try something that was a little bit different, because it was match dependent, because they knew Horford was going to be there. I thought it worked reasonably well. And yeah, I mean, you can go with that sort of thing. I mean, what the Celtics and the Raptors need to figure out is, what is the most important strength that we could have in this extra guy? And what is the least tolerable weakness? Like, what is the thing that we can't survive? And that's why, like, for me, the problem with DeLon Wright and the Raptor stuff is that teams are just going to help off him. And yeah, he can attack a closeout, but I just don't think you're going to close out aggressively. With the Celtics, I think some of it is just baiting their bad shooters into bad shots. And so that's similar, but a little bit different. And that might be an argument in favor of Ojeleye, because he doesn't really chuck too much. He just has those weaknesses so that opponents will help off other people.
Yeah, I mean, he really, like, he's averaging only 6.3 field goal attempts per 36 minutes, which is incredibly low, and 9.7% usage, which is one of the lowest in the league, and 4.8 PER. Solid enough defensively, but man, I mean, the offense just is not there. The confidence is not there. Only 29% from three-point range as well, and he actually takes about 80% of his shots from downtown as well. Their clutch offense, you know, they had another clutch win against the Nets, 87-85. Not too impressive to only score 87 points against the Nets, but with Horford out, I think they are going to struggle offensively. It was the Irving show down the end. He took some bad ones, as he often does. He set up Jason Tatum for a really nice dunk when they ran a side pick and roll action. And then when they led by two, Irving did it on the left side of the floor with Tatum, had him wide open for a pick and pop three, and instead took a tough floater over two guys, and then ended up getting blown by Spencer Dinwiddie, who Ojeleye had a nice play to stop him at the rim. Dinwiddie got fouled a bunch of times on drives late, but Ojeleye's play there was not one of them. And then they ended up forcing a miss at the very end. But just still going to be something to watch very closely is this team's performance in clutch games. I think Brad Stevens is a part of that. Although worth noting that they 2 years ago had a better point differential than their record for most of the year. And then last year, of course, they were way better than their point differential, and they are the same this year in terms of their record. So still something to watch, that clutch offense.
This is an obvious point, but I think it just bears repeating that we're probably going to see the Celtics and Raptors throw more into the regular season than a lot of teams, because they know the incentive of finishing with the one seed, assuming Cleveland is in the 2-3. Like, the home court is kind of a small part of that, but just being on the opposite side of Cleveland, I mean, that potentially gets you an extra round, the chance of it, you know, maybe Cleveland gets an injury, anything like that. And so we could see those teams use a little bit more energy if it gets close. And the current projections are that it will be. I think 538 has it where Toronto at 59 wins, Boston at 57, and then Cleveland at 53. So if that's the case, I think you're going to see Toronto and Boston both push really hard until the last couple of days of the regular season.
Yeah, and avoiding Cleveland would be nice, but yeah, you say they are pushing hard, but it is worth noting that Kyrie is averaging less than 33 minutes per game.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying they're pushing hard right now. I'm saying that it'll be different, you know, because you see a lot of those teams, let's say the last 2 weeks of April, the last 2 weeks of the regular season in April, just kind of go, oh, you know, we want to get right and all that sort of stuff. But getting the one versus two difference this year is bigger than almost any year I can remember. But let's move on to Cleveland. Cleveland, 26-13, 3-5 since the last 15-60, including that strange loss in Sacramento when Vince Carter went off. Their net rating is plus 3.1, which is good for sixth, fourth in offense, 25th in defense. And the most important thing that has happened for Cleveland since the last 15-60 is Isaiah. We've talked about it in a couple different formats. Also, we did, people asked us on the Twitter NBA show. We talked about his opener on Dunked On, but he also played another game on Saturday against the Orlando Magic.
Yeah, 7 of 13 from the field, 19 points, did have 5 turnovers. That's one thing that you'll see a lot of times for guys coming back from injury is just what you can get away with your passes, maybe getting into some situations that you're not used to. So guys can't turn over a lot. So he had 5 turnovers, but 4 assists, 19 points, 7 of 13 from the field in 21 minutes as they won that one in an absolute shootout, 131-127. And Thomas's shot distribution in that game, 2 of 4 on 3-pointers, took 4 mid-rangers as well, and then was 2 of 4 at the rim. I think that'll be something very interesting to watch is, you know, how does his finishing at the rim look at something that's, despite his overall brilliance, has declined to some degree as he's gotten older and the athleticism has waned. But of course, this is a team that gives him a fair amount of spacing. His chemistry with Dwayne Wade will be something very interesting as well. They're also talking about Derrick Rose coming back soon, which and that basically Dwayne Wade will get some rest. But with Thomas back, Rose really does not have a place on this team at all. And Rose was signed, of course, long before they knew that they would be acquiring Thomas acquiring Wade as well. How did Thomas look to you in that one?
He looked pretty good. I think that he's still moving better than I expected coming back from that torn labrum in his hip. I don't know why the labrum in the hip, because I always think of labrum with the shoulder, but he's doing well there. I like his chemistry with Tristan Thompson. That has been really good for Thompson, who has kind of struggled this year to find his place. And I mean, Love has done so well offensively. And, you know, I think he's been better than we expected at center defensively, just still not great, obviously. And so Thompson has been kind of going kind of rudderless a little bit when he's been able to play. And Thomas is just so good at finding the role guy and has so much, draws so much defensive attention that I think it's been very good for Thompson. I don't know where that goes. There are ideas of how Ty Lue should run his rotation once you give Thomas starters minutes, but that could be something that you build off of. And also the idea, as you said, of the Thomas Wade chemistry, because Wade he's such a smart player and such a good passer that can play him in a couple different spots. And I really want to see how they mix and match this moving forward, because LeBron and shooter lineups are fantastic, and I would love to see more of that. But then playing Isaiah with some different things just to see what he can goose up would be great.
One thing that I don't expect Lou to goose up is minutes with Kevin Love at power forward. Those lineups have not worked particularly well. Some of those coming early in the season with Tristan Thompson before his calf injury, when they were really playing poorly. They have not tried those guys together much. Some of it has been Love and Fry together during that also. They haven't been able to stop anyone during those times. With Love at center, they've been much better, and he actually is shooting a career best 62% true shooting. By the way, interesting note here, true shooting, you know, back when we first started doing this, the league average true shooting was like 53-54%. Now it's almost 56%.
Mm-hmm.
So worth noting just kind of what average is. I mean, you really, to be outstanding in that statistic now, you really got to probably be over 60%, whereas high 50s used to be pretty good.
Well, so one thing I want to mention with the Love thing is I think it's a very good regular season lineup, and it can work in the first couple rounds of the East playoffs as well. But in order to beat the Warriors or the Rockets, which presumably if the Cavs want to win a title, they have to, I think they have to defend better than they do with Love at center. And yes, you're right, they've defended better overall this season with Love at the five, but the ceiling of those lineups against the best of the best to me is too limited to make it your best shot. It's a shot worth taking, but not your best one.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And certainly, you know, we've said many times, and we've kind of just forgotten about this because Cleveland did win the championship, although, you know, not much thanks to Love, as you'll recall, in that series. And then Love, his individual statistics at times were good in the finals last year, but obviously they couldn't stop anyone. And well, I think he gives a lot more effort than certain other Cavs. It's still difficult to have a good defense with him out there. And so it still wouldn't be impossible to me that their best lineups against the best teams wouldn't include him. But, and there have been a few games that he hasn't closed the series, not playing a ton of minutes this season either.
Well, I want to clarify that I meant that he's not playing center, not that he's not playing at all.
Yeah. No. Well, I wasn't saying that you were, I was saying that I think.
Yeah. You know, okay. I just wanted to make sure that there was a correct interpretation. I want to talk a little bit about LeBron in the clutch as well, just because it's been so superlative this year. 24 games where it's been within 5 points in the last 5 minutes. Usage rate, these are the NBA.com stats. As some people know, the calculations can be a little bit different depending on your source here. Usage rate is 49.8%, which is number one in the league. It's ludicrously high. But he, on top of that, 62.7% true shooting. We just talked about how his true shooting percentage over 60 is really, really good. Well, LeBron does that in clutch time despite the highest usage. Also, 63.3% assist percentage, which is insane, and a plus 26.7 net rating. They're 16-8 in those games. So if for those who like the counting stats, 84 minutes, 115 points, 19 assists. Ridiculous.
All right, well, let's move on here. Who is next in the standings these days in the East?
The Washington Wizards, despite their loss on Saturday to the Milwaukee Bucks, which was, you call it a comeback loss. That game went back and forth a lot. They are 23-17, 7-3 since last time we covered them. Plus 3 net rating is good for 7th in the league, 10th in offense, surprising 7th in defense. And 538 gives them an 85% chance of making the playoffs. I think it's probably a little better than that, but I guess, you know, when you're only 6 games over 500, they could fall back. And
let me ask you this. I mean, isn't there like a 15% chance at least that, you know, John Wall or Brad Beal suffers an injury that like really impacts their availability the rest of the year? You know, I mean,
all they need is Thomas Sadaransky to deliver again. But
yeah, so I wanted to talk about that 7th in defense. Zach Lowe wrote a little bit about this, but I want to get into it even more. This doesn't seem like the 7th best defense in the NBA, does it? Just based on the talent that they have.
No, it really doesn't. And they have been inconsistent over the last couple years. They really did buy in early in the Whitman time, which was largely the same core of this team, and then fell out of it in the Whitman year. And
well,
there's
a very important distinction there early in the Whitman years, and that was they were playing Gortat and Nene together. And, you know, still even, number one, the game was different back then, and it was a different Nene than now. Toils in Houston, but just playing those two bigs together, I mean, they did defend, and it is still easier to defend when you have two bigs out there as a general proposition against most teams. If you're playing, you know, a Golden State or a Houston or something, maybe it's different.
That's true. And what is a really, really big thing to look at here, and longtime listeners will understand my focus on this, is opponent 3-point shooting percentage. And the Wizards are allowing, opponents are shooting 33.5% on them, which is actually the lowest percentage in the league. So that's really, really good. And while there are assertions out there that certain teams are better at 3-point defense, the Celtics and the Warriors being two of those, the Wizards do not have that history in their back pocket. They've allowed 37% or higher the last 2 years. And so you don't expect that part of it to continue. They're still giving up a really high proportion and a pretty significant amount at the rim. And they're not really holding opponents to great shots. It's just kind of a middling distribution. So if that comes back to the field a little bit, just even that component of it, their numbers will look a lot worse.
Yeah. And 7th in defense, you know, it's a single digit number. It looks good, but you're not really that far away from middle of the pack if you just slip a little bit when you're there. there. Usually you got to be, you know, kind of top five to really kind of have some separation from the middle of the pack, especially these days when the distribution of the best and worst defenses is not as large as it is with the best offenses. I want to talk about John Wall. He has made some strides this year in cutting his turnovers, which has always been a problem, turning the ball over too much. Still a fabulous passer, of course, but some danger signs as well. Actually, I guess I'll continue with the good stuff too. Career high 1.6% block percentage, and you know, he's still easily the best shot blocking point guard of all time, and he has, I think, made even more of an effort to be somewhat of a rim protector. And as players get smaller and smaller and there's more space on the floor, you see smaller players doing more rim protecting, I think, than you did in the past. But he's shooting 44% from two-point range, and that was down from 48% last year, and he really just has not been efficient enough. I mean, he's been, you know, true shooting percentage around 50-51%, and in this day and age, I mean, I know I'm not saying he's a bad offensive player still, but if you're really talking about him being as an upper echelon type of player in the league, you know, he just has to be more efficient with his own offense. And he's been shooting threes reasonably well. Where he's really been off is on mid-rangers. He is shooting 26% on mid-rangers, and he was 2 of 10 on mid-range against the Bucks in that loss. And that's particularly a problem because at the end of games, it makes him pretty switchable. And you can put a power forward on him and say, all right, you know what, like, we're going to back off a little bit. And yeah, take that mid-ranger. We'll just get a decent contest, but we're not going to let you get all the way to the rim. And he's taking fewer shots at the rim, although still pretty solid, 39% of his shots as opposed to 45% last year, which was a career best. And then also just has not been hitting the free throws. He is basically an 80% shooter for his career. He's at 70% this year, so that'll hurt your efficiency as well. He's a guy who gets to the foul line, and we haven't seen quite as many of the awesome dunks from him. And also worth noting too that he's had some pretty big minute games lately. He played 42 minutes against the Bucks in that loss. As I guess part of that is they were coming back and they felt like, all right, we got some momentum, we're not going to take him out. But remember, this is a guy who's had all these knee problems in his career. Bradley Beal played 42 minutes in that game as well. He's had that stress fracture problems, and Wall missed 2 weeks pretty recently with just kind of general overuse knee soreness. Not really the type of guy that you want playing 42 minutes a game during the regular season.
And I don't know if you know that I looked this up, but the Wizards are 26th in clutch offense this year. They have a 99.5 offensive rating in those clutch situations, which are 83 minutes so far. They're actually below 500 in clutch games. And some of that is bad luck, you know, just having some rough games, including some when Wall didn't play. Like, there was that one where Beal missed a bunch of shots late. Washington fans will remember what game that was. I can't remember which of their painful losses that was. But certain elements of that are structural. It's just like, who's going to kill you one-on-one against this team, especially when the opponent is really amped up defensively. And that was a problem in elements of that series against Boston last year, especially in Game 7 when their tired legs couldn't hit shots. And so I don't think it's going to be that bad, get it moving forward. But when you look at it, you go, okay, how are they going to make the best of the best stress out late in games? And they have talent, but they don't really have that kind of talent.
Yeah, I agree with you. And their transition game is very fearsome, and they are a team that can get hot. But yeah, in 4 out of 7 games, if it's down at the end, I just don't see the guy who is just freaking you out offensively, because yeah, they might be able to have more shooting on the floor than they've had in the past, but I just don't think that Wall is necessarily an efficient option. Okay, where are we going next?
By virtue of their own comeback win today, the Miami Heat are now in 5th place by themselves by a whopping half game.
Isn't that insane? I mean, I know everybody's really compacted there, but that's pretty insane considering like what the fundamentals for this team are and, you know, where they have been at times this season, that they are right now 5th in the East.
Right. So they're 22-17, 7-3 since the last 15-60, but they have a negative 1.8 net rating, which is 21st in the league. They're 22nd in offense, 13th in defense. And that 13th in defense, I mean, we talked about their potential on that end, that could be better than it is right now.
73%. Yeah. Although a lot of their good defensive players are injured right now, you know?
Yes, they are. And we will talk about that. And 538 gives them a 73% chance of making the playoffs, which again, I think that's the best of any of the teams in their air. Oh, no, it's not, because Milwaukee and Detroit. That's right. Okay, Milwaukee and Detroit have a higher odds than them. Okay, but anyway, the game today, so we're recording this on Sunday night, they had a really nice comeback win. Donovan Mitchell and a couple other Jazz players, Rodney Hood, had had some really nice moments, and they'd gone up, I think it was 10 points with about three and a half minutes to go.
Yeah, they led the Jazz biggest lead was 95-87 with 4:30 remaining in that game. And then the Heat were able to come back and finally actually, I think, took their first lead in those last few minutes with a Josh Richardson layup with 5 seconds left.
How much did you enjoy watching Josh Richardson at the end of this game? He was delightful throughout, but I think you focused on the end of the game, and he was just everywhere.
Yeah, he was. When he had this beautiful lefty layup where he drove down the left lane line and eluded Derek Favors by extending out, never even putting his right hand on the ball for a layup. He had that game winning layup as well off a nice play, again attacking Favors. Had a dunk in transition during the last 4 minutes where his head was like up by the rim. He really got up. I didn't know he had quite that level of athleticism in terms of his explosion at the rim. He got cooked a couple of times one-on-one by Donovan Mitchell, but he also knocked the ball away from Mitchell out of bounds off of him in the last minute and got a possession back for the Heat. They still trailed even by five with under a minute 30 remaining in this one. So yeah, he was outstanding. He's been playing very well lately, and they've needed everything they can get from him. I mean, he was basically against the Jazz playing at the four in their closing lineup. They had Dragic, Tyler Johnson, Wayne Ellington, Richardson, and Olynyk. And so with that level of shooting around him, he was able to get to the rim. And, you know, he's had trouble with turnovers when he tries to create, but they did a nice job down the end of getting him the ball on the move where he can just go attack the rim and then have space around him. And it was basically he and Dragic doing most of the work offensively.
After today's game, Miami now has the number one clutch offense in the league for the entire season. And they are, I think, 16-7 in those circumstances. Last year, they were below 500. If you swing one or two of those games, they make the playoffs last year and don't draft Bam Adebayo, presumably. But they just have so many guys that can compete. And they have a lot of players that are particularly adept at guarding twos, which can be really useful. It depends a lot on the opponent. Like a Heat Wizards series would be really fascinating because they have all these guys that can defend guards. But I just... The challenge with them is how you want to put their lineups together. Because I did all this work in the kind of preceding this because I had been watching one of their other games. And I was noting how different their whole team looks with and without Hassan Whiteside. And so I went into the numbers and I looked at it. And what I started realizing as I got into it, though they've had very little lineup continuity because of all the injuries they've had, Waiters, Justice Winslow, numerous guys, is that a lot of that also just comes to the way that they put these lineups together. That their starters, their most used lineup is actually Dragic, Waiters, Richardson, Winslow, and Whiteside, still 125 minutes in 11 games. That's the most used lineup because they've had so many injuries. Is that they play Whiteside with a lot of their more limited offensive players, and so it's those second units that flourish. And I think a mixed unit might actually help them in certain circumstances.
Yeah, and also worth noting that with the amount of time that Whiteside has missed, it really doesn't seem like he's 100%. He's
right.
Not had some of the effects that we've seen from him. And you know, they've been closing with Olynyk as they did today, and that's I think it's interesting. There are definitely circumstances in which, and against this Jazz team that really moves the ball and has guys who can shoot the ball off the bounce from three out of pick and rolls, and DHO's Olynyk's superior mobility was probably the better choice. You know, it wasn't like the Jazz had Rudy Gobert out there either, so I understand that. But you know, I mean, he has not been closing many games lately, and for a guy who has put up some big statistics in his career, you know, he's not exactly like Mr. Team. You know, if you looked over on the bench, yeah, he was standing up at the end, but he was just kind of like, all right, I guess I have to stand up. You know, he wasn't really into the body language as much when Richardson hit that winning layup. But you know, no, you're always gonna have guys who aren't that happy on a team. It's interesting that he is still by far the highest paid guy on this squad. But you have to wonder how long this can last for the team, especially with the injuries that they they have. Winslow is still, you know, I don't think he should necessarily be starting, but he's still basically week to week. Magruder is still out. Waiters, no talk of a return date for him. He's getting a second opinion on his ankle soon, and maybe that second opinion will say, hey, you know what, it's time for the surgery. Like, you're not going to be able to play the rest of the year anyway. By the way, Waiters, if he misses three more games, will miss out on $1 million incentive in his contract for games played. That's part of how they were able to shoehorn him in initially. So I don't know. This team, they're pretty close to where I thought they'd be record-wise, but it's clear that based on their fundamentals that they are just, you know, nowhere near as good as that 22-17 number five seed in the East would indicate, despite the fact they keep managing to pull games out somehow. I don't think there is anything particularly sustainable about that. And if you want some evidence of that, just go back to the fact that last year when they went to, you know, they were 10-31 to start with, they were way worse as a clutch team than their point differential would have indicated. So it's not like there's just something about these players that they're just going to be clutch every game. Like, these same guys just didn't get it done in those circumstances for the whole first half of the year last year.
I don't really have any disagreements with that, but I do want to congratulate Hassan Whiteside on getting his 13th assist of the season today. That's 13 assists in 535 minutes this season.
And I also, going back to that Jazz Heat game, I thought that Spo did a very nice job of getting Richardson and Dragic the ball on the move in pick and roll. They caused major problems with the Mitchell was guarding Dragic, and Dragic really was able to cook him pretty well. And get the switch, and then Olynyk did a nice job being physical. He got to the foul line a couple times at the end, and then Spo, after they forced a nice miss by Richardson, starting off by denying Mitchell the ball, and then they had Rodney Hood, and Rodney Hood just waved everyone away and took a terrible three that missed just about everything. They pushed the ball up. Spo did not call timeout, and then when it looked like things were not working out, he sprinted out onto the court with about 8 seconds remaining in the game and called the timeout and set something up, which is exactly how you should play it as a coach. So, and it worked out well for them as they got a layup basically within 3 seconds.
Anything else on them, or do you want to move on?
Yeah, let's do one more team here before we take it to that part two.
This would be a fun one to end it on. The Milwaukee Bucks are actually in a tie with this next spot. So Miami was in a tie with this as well, but by virtue of winning that game, they moved in. So then the Bucks, I gave them the tiebreaker because I think they've beaten the Pistons 2 out of 3. They're 21-17, 6-4 since last time we did this. -1 net rating puts them 17th in the league. They're 9th in offense, 26th in defense, and 80% playoff odds. Since the last time we did this, I mentioned they're 6-4. Four of their wins are just really impressive. They were all single digits, but they're just against really good opponents. Cleveland, Minnesota, at OKC, at Washington. And that Washington win talked a little bit about in their section. And they're 17-11 since they acquired Eric Bledsoe, plus 2.2 net rating just overall. And of course, the stats with Bledsoe out there are even more impressive.
Yeah, with Giannis and Bledsoe out there, they are plus 7.9. Their main starting five of Bledsoe, Snell, Middleton, Giannis, and John Henson has a plus 13.4 net rating. That's obviously a great reason to bring Tony Snell off the bench and start Malcolm Brogdon, as Kidd has been doing lately. The whole point of Brogdon is the additional playmaking that he provides. He really is just a sieve defensively at this point. I mean, if you want to see an example of his defense, by the way, you can go look at that dunk that Westbrook had on Thon Maker and see, you know, that he just does not have any kind of juice staying in front of guys. But getting back to just how good they have been overall, and since Bledsoe was acquired, the only guys with net ratings are the recently released DeAndre Liggins, which we'll get to, and the aforementioned Brogdon, and he's not even that bad, -1.7. Still another concern, as we said, with their opponents on Saturday, the Wizards, the minutes. Giannis, again, another guy who's missed time with knee soreness, and he basically was on his way to play like 45 minutes, and Kidd did the thing where he just plays in the first 18 minutes of the second half, and suddenly then he got his fifth foul, and then Kidd took him out for like 3 or 4 minutes, which, you know, Bob Vilgaris was joking that he was going to save him for the last possession, basically do like the Mike Budenholzer with Al Horford back in the 2015 playoffs. But he brought him back in with 3 minutes left, and he actually had a ton of juice to close out the game as they won it by 7 after it was pretty close down the end. But man, I mean, Middleton 42 minutes, Giannis 41, even with the foul trouble, was just you know, they can't keep on like this. It's just, I mean, maybe they can, but you're certainly tempting fate.
They are pushing, of course, for the playoffs, and the hope would be that when Jabari returns, that that will just dissipate some of that pressure. They are really missing Mirza Teletovic just as another guy who can play some minutes for them at the forward spots. I mean, he's a four, but it's still, you know, it all kind of fits together with them. And let's talk a little bit about the upheaval. Upheaval makes it sound like it's on more important players than it is, but they've had a lot of little moves over the last little while. So they cut DeAndre Liggins, which was disappointing for certain elements of the team, and Jason Kidd, who had been playing him some serious minutes. And they signed Xavier Munford.
Was there actually reporting on that people were like pissed off that he got cut?
There was some like, you know, a disappointment in the locker room or something like that. But you need, I don't know. I don't know how in depth that was or who they talked to or anything like that. I just remember seeing it. But so they did that, and then they signed Xavier Munford to a two-way. So that was all prologue to today, because Sunday, January 17th is the last day that you can cut a guy before their contract gets fully guaranteed for the rest of the season, even if they were on a non-guaranteed contract. So they had a roster spot to use. And what they did was something pretty interesting. They had Joel Bolomboy on a two-way contract. They signed him to their full roster, to an NBA contract, and then immediately cut him. Presumably the reason they did that was to make it easier for him to get onto their G League team, because basically then if a team wanted to claim him, they had to claim him for a fully guaranteed NBA contract for the rest of the year. So they paid an extra $22,000 to do that. And then they immediately cut him, and then they signed Sean Kilpatrick, who they had previously had, to a rest of the season contract. So we'll see if those machinations actually work out. I fully expect them to. But, you know, good to see John Horst doing something. And I'm sure they want Ball and Boy on their G League team. And so with all that sound and fury, they don't end up with something dramatically different than what they had, except that Wiggins had played, what was it, like 12 games where he played 18 or more minutes?
Yeah, well, this is great here. So Adrian Wojnarowski is a fantastic reporter, easily the best newsbreaker that we've essentially ever seen in basketball reporting, probably the best really in any sport. But if you would like to know in part how he gets some of these stories, and obviously personal relationships are part of it, this is the article that he wrote, like a 5-paragraph one, included these nuggets about Liggins, who had a negative 8.9 net rating in 480 minutes, and after Bledsoe, it was no better. And outside of Liggins, every other player in their rotation was like negative 1 or above. So they included some of the following lines. In games that Liggins played 18 minutes or more, Milwaukee was 10-1. That stat has to have come like directly from either Liggins' agent, or he says to ESPN Stats and Info, find me a stat that'll make this guy look good as a favor to his agent. That Liggins, 31, which I think is wrong, he's not 30, could be claimed on waivers or become one of the league's top candidates to sign a 10-day contract. There continue to be multiple teams interested in available wing players throughout the NBA, although he did at least acknowledge his limited shooting ability. So it's a lot of stuff that just, you know, doesn't really mean much, but it's like you can tell that the thought process in the article is, all right, I better say something good about this guy as like a favor to his agent. And that's how, you know, those agents then give him the news that he wants. It's very much a quid pro quo.
DeAndre Liggins is 29. He'll turn 30 in a couple months. And the other thing I wanted to mention briefly with them is that they traded the pick for Bledsoe, which is protected. Basically, they keep it if it's 17 to 30 or 1 to 10. And my preliminary assumption at the beginning of when the trade was made was that, oh, the bottom two records in the playoffs will be in the East, so they have to finish, you know, 6 seed or above to keep the pick. Well, that's a little bit more up in the air now that the bottom of the West is weaker. So it might even just be that they keep the pick if they make the playoffs. And I expect that they will have, that they'll be better than the 8 seed, but that is a little bit of latitude, because giving up the 16 pick in this draft, I mean, I haven't looked at how good it's going to be in that range, but I'm sure that's a pick that they would be less comfortable giving up than where they think they'll be in a year or two.
Let's do one more team, actually. That's only 6. Let's do one more. I'm on a roll here.
Well, that's good also, because the other team is the team that's tied with the Milwaukee Bucks, so we'll kind of done this troika that are all basically with the same record. That team is the Detroit Pistons. The Pistons are 21-17, 4-4 since the last 15-60, slightly negative net rating, negative 0.3, that's 15th in the league. They're 19th in offense, 11th in defense, and 538 gives them a 76% chance of making the playoffs. And their January 7th move was that they unsurprisingly guaranteed Eric Moreland's contract for the remainder of the season. Andre Drummond has missed the last couple of games due to sore ribs. He's questionable for their next game. And so Moreland actually started on the day that they informed him that they were going to pick him up for the rest of the year. And he started at center for them, as he's kind of been bouncing back and forth a little bit with Boban Marjanovic, who has been the subject of intrigue. I mean, I think that I watched the beginning of that game where they played against the Miami Heat, and it was a wonderful encapsulation of something. And I think it had come, that game happened right after Chris Herring's piece at 538 came out. I can't remember what the chronology was, but they were close, about the idea that Boban is this remarkably efficient scorer, but there's a reason why he doesn't play that much despite that historical offensive efficiency.
Yeah, and that is that he's tethered to the paint. And in fact, he talks about the matchup with Kelly Olynyk and the Heat in this game, where Olynyk scored 8 points in a row, basically in an 8-0 run with Boban trying to guard him. And we've talked about, hey, you know what? This guy is just so efficient offensively. Let's just see what happens if you put him out there. And now Olynyk is a very tough matchup as a five. He's like a true stretch five who, you know, causes a lot of trouble for traditional centers. And so after that run, Van Gundy took him out and only played him when Olynyk wasn't on the floor. And so it's really, I still think that maybe, you know, there could be more situations to use him, talking about Boban here, but coaches are going to react to something like that that seems very acute. I mean, if a center is shooting mid-rangers, or you can exploit him in high pick and roll, because also you can exploit him if you just set a screen and he's not going to be able to get out on the floor and slide with anyone. So if you have a guy who can shoot threes off the dribble, you can score really easily. And then, you know, coaches kind of see something that acute on defense, and yeah, you know what, he'll score, he'll get offensive rebounds, but it's sort of like, it seems like he just should be doing that, you know, because he's finishing mostly what others are starting, or he's getting on the offensive glass. And so it doesn't really seem as spectacular when he does score as what some of his limitations are. And, you know, he's really slow in transition as well.
So another,
but, yeah, big, this is something we've known for a while.
Yeah. Another big factor that I think is it's a challenge for the Pistons is the fact that they have Andre Drummond when he's healthy on the team, because Drummond is better against traditional centers too. I mean, there was a vision of him when he was young, but both when he was at UConn and early at the Pistons, that he could be this switch defender and that he could do a good job in those sorts of circumstances. And there have been moments where he's looked okay there, but when I watch them, I don't see him as being that dynamic kind of guy. So I think you want to have him, you know, he's your guy when another team has their traditional centers out there. And so then that takes away a time that would be good for Boban. So you could go to a mix with a different team. You could go to sort of a mix and match approach, sort of like what the Warriors have periodically done with Zaza Pachulia, like in the Christmas Day game where they didn't play him, or that's actually something that Brad Stevens has done very well with Aaron Baines. But you can't do that if the guy above him on the pecking order has similar priorities and preferences, because then he's going to get those minutes first.
We should also talk about how they have looked since Reggie Jackson went down on the day after Christmas. They lost at Orlando, at the Heat, and then were brutally blown out at the Sixers, scoring only 78 points. But have also actually had some reasonable wins at home, beating the Rockets by 7 with no James Harden, of course, and the Spurs, who were playing without really nobody in that game, actually, when the Spurs only put up 79 points on them. Although obviously Kawhi was still in the phase of the comeback. Danny Green has not been the same, but nonetheless, that was a really nice win at home. So they've shown some ability here. It's just that their offense, they've scored well less than 100 points in 3 of the 5 games, all losses.
Well, I mean, their offensive rating in those 5 games is 98.6.
That's bad.
Real bad. And so their defense, 105.3, that's quite good for, you know, I mean, it's obviously a really small sample, but if you score that little, you're not going to beat that many people. And so, yeah, they got that, the Rock fight against the Spurs, which I thought they looked very good, and I thought they looked very good against the Rockets too. And there was a point in that game where it looked like it was getting away from them. They had like a 13-point lead, cut it to 3, but then they ended up pushing it back out, fought it off, which I thought was a nice job by them. But they're going to have to be better there, and I think they will be. Just in terms of the eye test, though?
Why are they going to be? I mean, so they're 2-3. I mean, why are they going to be better than that? without.
Well, no, the 2 and 3, they might not be better than, but the 98.6 offensive rating.
Like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, no. The overall, I mean, I think they'll be a little worse on defense and a little bit better on offense. And, yeah, that's about.
Well, so if you, I mean, what, like, just fundamentally, without Reggie Jackson, like, what kind of team are they? Like, what kind of win percentage team are they?
I think they're, like, oh, I was thinking about it in terms of the total wins. I was thinking more like a mid-30s.
Yeah, no, that's a better way to do it, actually.
Yeah, like a mid-30s, so they're like, something in that range.
Yeah, yeah, like a 35 win type of team. So
yeah, like so I would say they would be, you know, they would be on average like a slight favorite at home, like assuming like a league average team and a you know, a couple point underdog on the road.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if that is in fact the case, you know, they're looking at probably being right around 500, maybe a little bit below if and when Jackson can return. But, you know, again, we don't even know when that's going to be and how effective he'll be. He obviously really struggled to come back from that knee injury before. And this injury is not even supposed to be reevaluated for 6 to 8 weeks after suffering it in late December. And, you know, this is a bad enough injury that you wonder whether, you know, at least, especially until he has like a summer to rehab it, as he did with that knee tendonitis, you wonder about whether he's going to be able to give them that much. So I think hard to imagine for this team that they, I mean, I think they're probably, it's probably more likely that they make the playoffs than finish like above, you know, finish at the sixth seed or higher, I would say.
Something else to kind of keep in the back of your mind is that they play a lot of games in the near term against teams that you are kind of in that middle ground. So I talked about the idea of maybe being a slight underdog on the road. So they play New Orleans on Monday. That'll be a tough game for them. Then Brooklyn and Chicago on the road, so both those games, and then I expect them to lose at Toronto. But then it's like Charlotte at home, Washington at home, Brooklyn at home, Utah at home, OKC. Like, if they can go 3-2 and let's say those five home games, then, you know, that's a decent little foundation that they can build on. But if you go like 1-4 in those games, then this can start to get away from them. So we're gonna learn a lot more. I mean, they've had these couple of good games since Reggie's been out, and that's obviously encouraging and this can be good. But I want to see it get tested more, and we're going to get that opportunity. Hopefully Drummond comes back soon. I heard he's questionable for that game on Monday. After that, we'll see, because they do need more depth, and they need all of their guys like Tobias Harris that have been ridiculous shooting this year. They're going to need those guys to keep it up, because Ish Smith can be a capable steward for running their offense, but they're going to need a lot for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say that of the Sixers, Heat, and Pacers, the Pistons are probably looking, they are four games over 500 right now, but with the Jackson injury, they're looking like the least likely of those teams to me to make the playoffs, especially now that Oladipo has returned and all is right in Pacer land.
Their place in this is the nine spot. And so what I always determine by the nine spot is I mean that on talent. So what that means is somebody can fall past them and get them into the playoffs, but they're going to need somebody to fall past them.
All right, that'll do it for part one of our 15 and 6. We'll be back with the rest of the East. Don't forget our sponsor, SeatGeek. Use that cap space code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Talk to you all tomorrow. Till then.